This is Eileen Claudius from Harbor UCLA, and I'm here with Julie Brown, professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington and attending physician in the emergency department at Seattle Children's. She is also one of the investigators for the PCARN Stellar Node, and we're going to talk about anaphylaxis.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for your time. I have got to tell you, I had that classic patient the other day who came in with hives and GI symptoms like vomiting. And I had a long discussion with the resident about whether or not to give that child epinephrine. So I'm hoping by the end of the interview, I have a great answer from you. But let's table that for a minute and have you talk a little bit about the definition of anaphylaxis and whether you think this child we're discussing would qualify.
Can I ask you a few questions about this child first?
Absolutely not. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, go ahead.
Did they eat something before they developed those symptoms? And what kind of timing did you have? Because I think that will be relevant to the conversation. When did the symptoms start relevant to the ingestion, if there was one? And how persistent was that vomiting? Did they vomit once or many times? Are they still vomiting when you see them?
You know, Julie, I don't know about your patients, but here's how it goes with every single one of my patients. They ate something, but it was something that they'd had a million times before. The parents are absolutely certain that there was no added ingredient that could possibly be new. Of course, these are kids, so they're eating basically constantly. So it was in the last hour, but it was something like potatoes that had nothing else in them. Of course, it was like three episodes of vomiting. Everything was so nonspecific.
That story is actually pretty common because if you think about the pathophysiology of anaphylaxis, you actually have to have an exposure and a re-exposure in order to have an anaphylactic event. The first exposure to a food is what primes the immune system to then react with this brisk inflammatory response the second time. So while we often will have what seems like the first exposure to a new food, it is very likely that you had some perhaps small exposure to that food previously in order for that precipitating event to occur. We do often see these kids come in with something that seems innocuous, like maybe a meal that they've had in the past, and it can be really difficult to tease out what was in there. So let's get back to your question, which was, what are the criteria for anaphylaxis? And there was an expert and very comprehensive group that tried to develop good criteria to help us. It was comprised both of allergy experts and families. And one of the challenges is there are no signs or symptoms that are unique to anaphylaxis. And there are no tests that can be done in a timely enough manner to really help us in making the diagnosis. So what we rely on is a constellation of symptoms, as well as the exposure as a precipitating event. What they came up with are what are called the NIAID or NIAID / FAN, F-A-A-N criteria, or sometimes called the Sampson criteria. And there are three categories that can get you to meet the criteria for anaphylaxis. According to these NIAID FAN criteria, anaphylaxis is likely when one of the following criteria are met. The first criterion is there's an unknown allergen exposure, you have skin involvement, and either respiratory compromise or hypotension. The next criterion is there's a likely allergen exposure, and you have two of the following four items: skin involvement, respiratory compromise, reduced blood pressure, or persistent GI symptoms. The third criterion is there's a known allergen exposure and you have hypotension. So now you can see why I was asking you for a little bit more history on this child, because I wanted to know, does she meet criteria for persistent GI symptoms, which are not really ever clearly defined. The other thing that's not clearly defined is respiratory compromise. And I know a number of allergists who will be very liberal in their inclusion into that criteria. So a child, for example, who's having a persistent dry cough, they will consider respiratory compromise. So the application of those criteria kind of gets tricky. And then the next thing to be cognizant of is that these diagnostic criteria aren't necessarily what we should be using to determine who needs epinephrine. These are very different from the care plans that families are given to make decisions about when they should give epinephrine. And they have a much lower threshold if you look at the care plan of a family with food allergies for when they should give epinephrine. And often for them, it's two systems. One severe system, so severe severe respiratory distress or symptoms that are suggestive of hypotension or cardiovascular involvement, or two systems. So in the case of your child, for example, rash and GI symptoms would be sufficient to give epinephrine, whether or not we're going to decide that that meets criteria for anaphylaxis. There will be children who meet criteria for getting epinephrine who don't yet meet the diagnosis of anaphylaxis. And they gave the example of a child who has a known peanut allergy, who has eaten his allergen and is head to toe hives. You should not sit around waiting for him to develop more criteria of anaphylaxis. That child would warrant epinephrine.
And are you suggesting that we extrapolate these recommendations for epinephrine that we give to families at home to our use in the emergency department or in a physician's office as well?
I don't know that the care plans we give families are perfectly appropriate for us. But on the other hand, what has happened is that many practice parameters pull up these guidelines and use them as if that is what should determine who gets epinephrine and who doesn't. And I think they really have a limitation in terms of not taking into consideration timing and not taking into consideration that we ought to, in many cases, have a lower threshold for giving epinephrine than these strict criteria for the diagnosis of anaphylaxis suggest. And it's for this reason that I had spent a year as a clinical scholar and developed a tool that we could use in our emergency department that we call the ASAP, Anaphylaxis Score Assisting Providers, that is designed not to make a diagnosis of anaphylaxis, but to assist us in determining who meets a threshold for giving epinephrine at a particular moment in time, with the idea that that moment will be dynamic.
And for those of us that were too lazy to spend a year as a clinical scholar working on this, is there a website or some way that we can reach this scale that you've designed?
We do have our anaphylaxis pathway publicly available, and it is there as part of our anaphylaxis pathway. If you Google Seattle Children's Clinical Standard Work Pathways, you will find it. All of our pathways are publicly available, and the anaphylaxis pathway will be there as one of them.
Okay, so let's move on to the child who has obvious anaphylaxis. Perhaps they're hypotensive, perhaps they're clearly having respiratory distress, and the history is great for anaphylaxis in terms of an allergen exposure. How would you optimally manage that child? And what is the evidence behind the different treatments that are suggested?
Well, there's only one medication that has been shown to alter the course of anaphylaxis, and that's epinephrine. That is the mainstay of treatment that should be given first and foremost. You shouldn't give anything else like antihistamines or steroids and wait to see if they work first. So it's really all about epinephrine. In our pathway, we will give epinephrine first and wait to see a response without being aggressive with other interventions such as IV placement and fluid resuscitation, except for kids that we consider to have critical symptoms, which may include the child you just described. So if they have significant respiratory distress or hypotension, then we will put an IV in immediately because we want to have every option at our disposal. But for most other kids, the response to epinephrine is so good that we can get away without needing to put in an IV. And by giving a dose of epinephrine first and waiting for a response, we've been able to drastically reduce our IV insertion rate. The next most important thing is supportive intervention. So patient position is important. They should be ideally lying down because there is such vasodilation occurring in the context of anaphylaxis that it impairs venous return to the heart unless they are having respiratory distress and not comfortable in that position. That also is important when you're giving epinephrine because it supports optimal circulation. The next one is oxygen as needed. If they are hypoxic, you certainly want them to have optimal respiratory support and also being put in a position of comfort. Then we can talk about adjunctive medications such as antihistamines and steroids.
So are you still giving these medications, but just giving them orally? Are you only giving them in that sick patient that got the IV, or are you really not giving them unless they have a symptom?
There is a role particularly for antihistamines, which certainly will treat skin symptoms and they will treat upper respiratory symptoms, but they will not alter the course of the severe symptoms of anaphylaxis. You should really think about the fact that you are treating these as comfort measures. If you are going to treat with antihistamines, and in general, we do that when there are these skin or perhaps upper respiratory runny nose kind of symptoms. If you're going to use an H1 blocker, you should combine it with an H2 blocker. marker because 15% of mast cell receptors are H2 receptors. And there are two studies of mixed allergic reactions indicate that H1 and H2 blockers together are more effective than H1 medications used alone. So if you're going to use an H1 blocker, such as cetirizine, then you should add an H2 blocker, such as famotidine. Our pathway uses cetirizine because it has an onset of action that is just as fast as diphenhydramine, and it is a less sedating medication, which is what you want, particularly as you are sending families home from the emergency department, because what you don't want is for them to be giving a medication that makes their child sleepy, and then you don't know if they're sleepy because they were sedated by a medication or if they're sleepy because they're in fact hypotensive, which a family can't measure at home. There's really no reason to use diphenhydramine or Benadryl when you have the option for a less sedating antihistamine.
And what about steroids?
Steroids are an even more controversial medication in anaphylaxis. They certainly don't have any benefit in the very short term. And then there are no good randomized trials to show whether or not they have any benefit in preventing persistent symptoms or biphasic reactions. There was a study that suggested that for kids who are well enough to go home from the emergency department, steroids made no difference. But for kids who are sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, they reduced need for repeat doses of epinephrine and length of stay. There are theoretical reasons why steroids might help dampen an allergic reaction, and that has been the reason why most allergists developing asthma pathways have been reluctant to forego them altogether. And there's only one guideline that has been brave enough to come out and say not to add steroids, and most of the rest hedge. We use it for kids who have a history of asthma or wheezing, who have a history of biphasic or severe reaction. And then the third group is those who have a delayed time from exposure to symptom onset of greater than an hour, because that is known to be a higher risk group.
Now, I want to talk about patients that you're planning on dispositioning home in a minute, but which patients need to be admitted? If you give one dose of epinephrine and the patient gets better and stays better, can that patient go home? What if they don't get better and you give a second dose of epinephrine? Is that an automatic admission? Who are you deciding to admit with anaphylaxis?
You know, I think there's a difference between the child who gets one or two or perhaps even three doses in very short order up front and then gets well and stays well, and the child who gets a dose, gets better, then has some more symptoms, gets another dose, gets better, then has some more symptoms and needs another dose. Because that child clearly has ongoing reaction and has, I would say, an increased risk of more happening down the road that probably ought to be observed. So we have an admission criteria of persistent symptoms, which in our case is a score of greater than or equal to 5, which is our criteria for epinephrine, after two doses of epinephrine.
Now, if you do decide that a child is a candidate for discharge home, how long do you watch them for, and what prescriptions and follow-up do you give them when they are eventually discharged?
Anaphylaxis is mirroring what happened with croup, where we gave racemic epi. We used to admit everybody, and then we would watch for 6 hours, and then 3 hours, and then 2 hours. You know, we're pushing that envelope. I think we're starting to see similar things in anaphylaxis, that we probably don't need to watch kids as long, and we probably can identify a subset of lower risk kids who can go home sooner. Tim Dribben has been doing some really interesting work on trying to identify this population of low risk kids who probably don't need the kind of monitoring that we've been doing. On our pathway, what we have come to currently, and we may even try to push this envelope a little further, but currently we observe patients for 4 hours. But if they're in the lowest risk population, and we call that like a rose patients, if they meet all of our really low risk criteria, we observe them for 3 hours. And that 3 hours is from the last dose of epi or any worsening of symptoms. If they had a reason to get an antihistamine, then we send them home with a PR antihistamines, again, the H1 and H2 blocker. If they got a dose of steroids in the emergency department and they're going home, that's it. They don't need further steroids. We would have given a dose of dex and they wouldn't get further dex. Obviously, everybody needs an epinephrine auto-injector. Our practice is that they need to have that in hand because we know that people can have difficulties filling prescriptions in general at the pharmacy, and epinephrine auto-injectors in particular can be pretty challenging. They need to follow up with their regular doctor within a few days, and and we recommend that everybody see an allergist because this is a chronic medical illness that deserves specialist consultation.
Now, obviously, with the auto injectors and what we do in the emergency department, we're basically talking about intramuscular epinephrine. Is there a role for other forms of epinephrine? Do you ever give it IV in the very sick patient that you're having trouble controlling in the emergency department? And alternatively, are we ever going to have any type of auto injector that doesn't require an intramuscular shot?
First of all, I'm really glad you brought up IV epinephrine. It's really important to distinguish between IV bolus epinephrine and IV drip epinephrine. So, IV bolus epinephrine has the potential for significant cardiac side effects and is not recommended outside of cardiac arrest or significant hypotension when you're really on that arrest algorithm, not an anaphylaxis algorithm. It's intramuscular bolus doses for the first three doses. If you do have a patient who has required three intramuscular doses of epinephrine and they're still symptomatic, that's the time to plan to switch over to an epinephrine drip for anticipated continuing needs. But don't neglect to continue to give them IM epinephrine every 3 to 5 minutes until your drip is available. Now, on the flip side, you asked about other forms of epinephrine, particularly community use, although it may also eventually be an option for us. And there are really interesting things on the horizon. There is work being done to develop both sublingual and intranasal epinephrine, and there is some pretty compelling literature that we can get decent, rapid plasma levels of epinephrine with both of those forms. They are not yet FDA approved. The clinical studies are a little variable, but they've shown pretty decent plasma levels. But what they haven't been able to demonstrate so far, as it's really challenging, is how that correlates clinically. It's a really important area of investigation because the carriage of auto injectors is low, and even when carried, the use is low. There is such needle phobia that even parents who have it in hand and know that they should be using it are just terrified to do so for their child or patients for themselves. So this could be a game changer.
Okay, now let's get back to my initial case. Based on what you've said so far, you have a kid who had a potential allergen. We don't really know. He did eat something. He's having GI symptoms and a rash, but nothing life-threatening. What do we give that child for treatment?
How long is it since he last vomited?
In the waiting room.
If this happens within an hour of eating, I am going to err on the side of considering this a likely allergen exposure, even if what they ate was potatoes, because there's always the potential for cross-contamination. So I'm going to consider this a likely allergen exposure if he ate potatoes within that hour and then he has the skin findings and persistent GI symptoms. I always want to have a lower threshold for treating versus not treating, particularly in a previously healthy child, because epinephrine is an incredibly safe medication in a child. Certainly in our patient, the benefits of treating what may be anaphylaxis outweigh any downside. So I'm going to treat this child with epinephrine. And if I applied my ASAP to this child, he would get sufficient points to treat him based on that timing. Here's where the difference would be using my score versus using the criteria. If he hadn't vomited for 2 hours, he would score lower on my score and not meet criteria for epinephrine, where he would still meet those criteria for anaphylaxis.
So to summarize, in terms of treatment, if you have a child based on the potential for an allergen exposure, the proximity of symptoms, and the constellation of symptoms, you are fairly ubiquitously going to give, at this point in time, intramuscular epinephrine every 3 to 5 minutes until you get that under control. In patients with urticaria or respiratory symptoms, you are going to provide supportive care and then later add an oral H1 and H2 blocker, which they will eventually go home on. And in children who have significant symptoms of anaphylaxis or something like perhaps wheezing that would be expected to benefit from steroid use, they will get a single oral dose of dexamethasone, or if they're sick enough, I'm presuming an IV dose in the emergency department that will not necessarily be continued at home.
That's an excellent summary. Couldn't have done better.
Well, you don't have to because you have a whole algorithm out there, which when we don't remember exactly what was discussed on this podcast, we're going to look up and feel like you're guiding us through this process. So thank you for doing that now. And thank you for providing us a modality that can allow you to guide us through some of these more difficult decisions in the future when we don't have you talking in our ear.
My pleasure.
Is there anything else that you think is important for our listeners to know?
The allergists appreciate it when, in a child like the one you described, where we have some diagnostic uncertainty, that we treat the child as appropriate, but we don't necessarily have to label that entity as anaphylaxis. It's difficult for them to undo a diagnosis of anaphylaxis if, in fact, it ends up being something else down the road.
That sounds like a really important point as well, right? Because you don't want to carry around a diagnosis that you don't really have for the rest of your life, especially when you're starting at 3 years of age or 5 years of age. So thank you so much. Thank you for your insight and your time. And I really appreciate how much I've learned during this interview.